Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Sarah Passmore.
And I'm Hugh Tiverton. This morning we're talking about the G8.
Last weekend, hundreds of thousands of people around the world joined in a series of concerts and called for the most developed countries to take action to end poverty around the world.
Today in Scotland, the leader of those countries are meeting with the same goal on top of their agendas. There's exceptional pressure on them to bring debt relief to the poorest nations, to make global trade rules fairer, to increase aid, and to face the reality of climate change.
But there are still different ideas about how best to achieve these. Whether debt relief will fuel irresponsible spending and corruption, whether aid should be linked to achievement, and just how much we can do to change the weather.
So can G8 really make poverty history? What's your message for the meeting?
Call us on 233 88266 or you can email backchat at rthk.org.hk. Tell us what you think.
We've got a variety of guests joining us this morning, including the head of Oxfam Hong Kong, Professor Stephen Chung from City University, and on the line from the UK, Stephanie Tunmore, who's a climate campaigner with Greenpeace International. We'll talk maybe about climate change in a little while, but let's start with another guest in our central studio, David Webb. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
David's the editor and founder of website.com. David, I think of you as an arch-capitalist. Is that fair?
With limitations, yes.
With limitations. All right. Okay, given that, what would your hope be for the G8 summit?
They've got a number of big issues on their plate, including climate change. But if we're looking first at the trade issue, I think the most important thing is they need to bite the bullet on agricultural subsidies. The rich world currently spends about $250 billion per annum just supporting its farmers in various ways with direct subsidies, indirect subsidies, export subsidies. Import duties on third world agricultural produce. All of that needs to go, and it needs to go rapidly, because they can't preach free trade to the world and ask developing countries to open up their borders to inward investment and trade without addressing the problems they have at home. And this actually is not just a G8 question, but it's fundamental to the European Union's budget battles that are going on at the moment, because over half the European Union's budget goes on supporting European farmers. And they've spent about 40 billion euros per annum supporting the European farming community. And that is something that France wants to continue and Britain wants to cut back. And it's at the core of their arguments within Europe. So it's a European argument, it's a G8 argument, and it's a global argument. It's simply unfair to the developing world to say that we're going to dump subsidised agricultural produce so that you can't sell yours.
Mm. And trade is going to be an issue which will be taken up in December with the WTO here in Hong Kong. So it'll be interesting to see it continued here.
Yes, Hong Kong has a chance in December to go down in history as either the place where the big breakthrough was made on trade liberalisation or the place at which the Doha round collapsed.
Mm. All right, Professor Stephen Chung. Stephen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you think trade, world trade at the moment, is unfair?
It seems like it's unfair because when you look at the problems with African country, the poorest population actually they live in a suburban area. Most of them are farmers. And then in order to help Africa, to help itself, I think the best way to reduce poverty is through economic growth. And how can we boost economic growth? How can we help them, help Africa to help itself? I think important is it's not simply by increasing aid. I mean, one problem is mentioned by David, is to help them to enable them to grow their own crop, to sell the crop in the international market. On the other hand, I think it's very important to make sure to monitor how this country use aid efficiently. The aid sometimes end up, according to the past experience, the aid money sometimes end up in corrupted government official pocket. And sometimes, end up in the multinational pocket to sell arms to this country. I think important thing is two dimension. One is the trade issue. Another is how to monitor the use of aid money.
Now, you have in front of you a book, The End of Poverty, which people might remember because it was around at the turn of the century, wasn't it? And it encapsulates some of those UN millennium hopes.
Cool, yeah.
5 years on, have they come to anything? I mean, there is no particular sign of an end to poverty, is there?
Not that much has been done. I mean, but that we have to look back, you know, in the past two decades. If we record it correctly, I mean, this concept, I mean, the life aid concept has been done similarly in the UK, I think, about 20-something years ago. That based on the famine in Ethiopia. But the point is, loads of money, tons of money has been flowed to Africa since then, but not that much has been done. And then the remaining question is how we should monitor the use of this money effectively. I think that is the key questions. How can we link to the effectiveness and also the achievement of this money to the distribution of money?
They're not just talking about aid, though, are they? They're talking about debt relief, relieving those countries of debt. Do you think that would make a difference?
Well, that would make a difference. I mean, precisely according to Jeffrey Sack, the author of this book, he claimed that Africa has been trapped in some poverty gap, meaning that these countries simply are too poor to generate any economic growth. For example, I mean, these farmers in African country, they are too poor to buy any seed to grow in the farmland. So how can we get them out of poverty gap? I mean, country getting poorer in the past two decades, the rich country getting richer also in the past two decades. So what should be done? Aids or debt relief are on the table. I mean, these are the two top agenda items on the table. But again, you know, how to use the money effectively is more important.
Chong Cheng Yao is head of Oxfam Hong Kong. He's in our central studio. Mr. Chong, hello to you.
Hi.
Professor Cheng is right. Many African nations are actually poorer than they were 5-10 years ago, despite massive amounts of aid. Why do you think that more aid, more help from the West will make any difference?
Well, actually, I want to put the record correctly. It is not loads of aid. In fact, we calculate that last year was the low point of aid. So the aid level was half of that in the 1960s. And the UN has a target of rich country setting aside 0.7% of GDP for aid. And no country has achieved it among the G8, and the average is about 0.24. So right now, the G8 countries spend one-tenth of this amount, about $56 billion US dollars on aid, whereas they spend $610 billion on military expenditure. So in a way, Jeffrey Sachs and other people are calculating that if we want to end poverty, we need to increase aid by $50 billion starting next year. And the G8 countries in Scotland are now dragging on their feet. They're not going to do that. So I dispute the statement that loads of aid has been spent. In fact, it is not enough. And African countries spend more money on interest repayment than the aid that they receive, and they spend more interest repayment on that than they are able to spend on health and education in their own countries. That's the situation.
When you talk about aid and giving aid to these countries, do you believe that the aid should go via charities such as Oxfam, who know exactly where the money is going, or should they just be given to the governments of the countries? Because that's been one of the biggest criticisms, hasn't it, that a lot of these countries are led by tyrants and dictators who spend the money on things other than the people of the country.
Well, one of the criticisms about aid is on corruptions. We also want to say that if well-managed, organizations such as Oxfam or other NGOs are able to use the money correctly, and we see child going back to school, we see health being addressed, and even within governments in the developing countries, corruption is not in the way of countries being able to resend their children back to school after that relief that's happening in Tanzania and other countries. So we don't think corruption is really a reason for not giving aid, and it is being used as an excuse, rather. I mean, any country has corruption problems, and we should not pinpoint developing countries. You see many corporations are giving bribes. The OECD statistics show that companies actually are responsible for $80 billion of bribes, and this is also one cause of corruptions. And it is from private sector, not from aid.
But isn't there also, by the same token, a lot of private money which is being sent in the form of aid, and that when people quote figures about how much of the GDP of a country is given in aid, they often don't include those private donations, which can be very substantial. In the case of North America, for example, the US private companies give enormous amounts of money to sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, I don't have the figure right now. The estimation is that the private donation is still smaller than official aid. Right now, the official aid is $56 billion a year. So I think money raised from the citizens channeled through NGOs or given directly from companies still will be a small proportion of that.
Okay. So do you believe that all developing countries should be dealt with in the same way, that no matter what kind of government they have in place, if they need help, they should get aid?
Well, I think we should support civil societies in developing countries. We should support governments which are willing to improve. We should support, actually, institution building in these countries. I mean, one of the causes of corruption, of course, is the low salary of civil servants, and also the willingness of multinational companies to get by in some of the ways. So, I mean, there are many other causes of corruption that we have to deal with. But let's not make it in the way of saving children, saving women from poverty.
All right, you're listening to RTHK Radio 3, the Backchat program.
Call 233-88266 or email backchat at rthk.org.hk.
We're talking this morning about the G8 summit coming up today in Scotland, in the UK. What are your thoughts, your wishes, your hopes? What would you like to be on their agenda? Do give us a call or drop us a line. I guess number two on the agenda, apart from Africa, is climate change. And we're joined on the line now by Stephanie Tunmore, who's a climate campaigner with Greenpeace International, now in the UK. Stephanie, good morning to you. Thank you for staying up.
Good morning.
Is there some connection between poverty and climate change, or is it just a sort of ragbag list, do you think?
No, there's definitely some a huge connection between poverty and climate change, although I'm not sure how much of that connection the people the meeting at the G8 understand. For instance, the focus on Africa and debt relief will be completely undermined by climate change if something isn't done to stop it. Global warming is already affecting Africa, and if it isn't restrained in some way, they will find that the conditions that they're struggling under now will just intensify. So yes, there are definite links between poverty and climate change.
And are there definite links between climate change and anything that the G8 people can do?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, seven of the G8 leaders are actually signed up to the Kyoto Protocol. So have already made commitments to reduce their greenhouse emissions. And I think we're not asking for the G8 to start a whole new process. We already have this process. But what we do need from them is a reaffirmation of the commitment to reduce emissions and deal with climate change. And that means a strong statement on the science. You know, we already know enough about the science to know that we need to be taking some action. And obviously, it's no secret that the biggest concern here is the U.S. administration, is George Bush, because they have consistently refused to join the international community to reduce their emissions. And one of the problems with the G8 summit is that they will search for a consensus, which means they will go to the lowest common denominator in their agreement. Now, if they do that with George Bush, we will end up with a communique which is still stressing scientific uncertainties and talking about silver bullet solutions which may or may not happen in the future, And that would be a big step backwards for the seven leaders that are all that have already ratified Kyoto. And it would also, I mean, in spite of the Bush administration, there's a lot going on in the USA in terms of climate protection, the states, the regions, industry. People there are beginning to be very concerned, and very concerned at the lack of leadership from their government. So action is being taken. And an endorsement of Bush's position on climate change by the other G8 leaders would actually set that back, would slow the momentum in the US.
If you look at America and Great Britain as being on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to climate change, what about all the other countries in the G8 meeting?
Well, as I said, all of them have signed up to the Kyoto Protocol. They've all accepted legally binding targets. There is obviously, it's in the detail, that the disagreement it will be in the detail. But the general acceptance of the science and the urgency and the need to take action is actually agreed by those other seven leaders.
You say there are hopeful signs from America, but George Bush, just in an interview in the UK this week, said, didn't he, Kyoto would have destroyed the American economy.
Yeah, when I said hopeful signs in America, I wasn't actually talking about George Bush. Mm. I was talking about outside of the federal government. And yes, George Bush has been saying that about the economy for a long time. And it simply isn't true. And, I mean, look at the statement that the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, made earlier this week. He doesn't believe that either. He thinks it is possible to reduce emissions, to protect the climate, and to prosper economically. And that's a view that's gaining ground in the US. The idea that it would wreck the economy basically came from the conservative right before the Kyoto Agreement was ever signed. And it's something that's continued. It's a myth that's continued, but it's not strictly true.
Have any of the G7, G8 countries actually reduced emissions since signing the Kyoto Protocol?
I think that's very hard to tell. There's probably been some small savings, but the Kyoto Protocol itself, if you look at what it's trying to achieve, it's only a 5% cut globally. The thing with emissions is you have to actually begin to slow them, then stop, and then reverse. And at this point, the Kyoto Protocol has only been ratified since the beginning of this year. The policies and measures that are required to reduce emissions are just being put in place. So I don't think we can expect anything dramatic at the moment. And the savings that they have to make in this period are between 2010 and 2012. Sorry, 2008 and 2010. So I think you can see that there's real political will in many of those countries that policies and measures are being put into place. But in terms of actually measuring the reductions at this point, you probably can't.
I mean, I'm sure you don't agree with Bush that Kyoto would have destroyed the American economy, but it would cost more, wouldn't it? I mean, it will cost world economies. Stephen Chung, you're nodding here. It would cost to cut emissions, wouldn't it? It would certainly cost a country like China.
Yeah, but it will introduce a cost in the short term, but in the long term, it will benefit everybody globally. This is the way I see it. So it's the short term sacrifice for long term objective. I think George Bush is very very short sighted. I mean, he's a typical politician.
But as you say, a typical politician. I mean, a typical democratic politician under a democracy. People have got a 4-year frame of reference, haven't they, David Webb?
I think you've got to look at this taking into account all the costs. It's easy to say that it's going to cost money to reduce emissions, but we're not actually pricing economically at the moment the cost of pollution. And if you actually look at the damage that it causes, sulfur dioxide emissions from power stations, as well as the CO2 effects, then the consequences of not doing something about it are probably much more expensive in the long run. The science on this... It's known that we have the highest levels of CO2 in the atmosphere that we've had for the last 200,000 years. Now, humans weren't around 200,000 years ago in any recognizable form. But if you look at the Antarctic ice core samples where air was trapped that long ago, we know for a fact that our CO2 levels are higher than they've ever been. Where the scientists are still disagreeing is on what the actual effect of this will be over the next, say, 100 years. Would it be half a degree's increase in the temperature or 7 degrees? But it seems to me, from an economic perspective, we can't afford not to take the take the bet that it will be 7 degrees and devastating to the global climate and economy, and therefore make the relatively small investments in CO2 reductions and on scientific research on things like fusion reactors, where we're only spending $10 billion over the next 10 years on ITER, to make that bet that the downside is right, that it is going to be 7 degrees increase, and that the polar caps will melt and vast areas of the developed world, like Manhattan and London, would be flooded. The cost of those things is much higher than the cost of limiting emissions.
But fusion technology, enormous amounts of money, massive amounts of money have been spent to no end at all.
That's not true. I mean, if you think about, put it in perspective, $10 billion.
Not a watt has been generated, has it, by fusion energy?
Not yet.
No.
But the point is that the research needs to be done, and the governments have finally agreed to build the experimental reactor in Cadarache in France. They're only going to spend $10 billion over the next 10 years. America is spending $100 billion in 1 year in Iraq on military spending. So put it in perspective, it's a tiny fraction of global GDP to make bets like fusion and other forms of better solar cells and so on to go for emissions-free energy.
But cutting emissions, developing fusion energy, aren't those classic examples of the kind of long-term social problems which the free market and a free market economy are not able to deal with?
Market is not able to finance fusion research, for example, because of the very, very long payback and uncertain payback periods. And that's why the governments of the world have to get together and do it, and they are doing it. But they're doing it on, in my view, not just on fusion, but on other forms of energy research in too limited a fashion. And if they step up to the plate on that and spend relatively small amounts in global terms, the potential payback is huge, and the potential protection that we buy against the effects of global warming are huge.
Isn't that because they're blinded by the ideology of a free market?
No, I think it's because they are driven by electoral imperatives. It's difficult to explain to the population why you want to triple or quintuple expenditure on things that might not yield results for another 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, how do you do that? You have one party who says, we'll do that, it's going to cost you, and you won't see the benefit. And you have another party who says, we're not going to, we're going to cut your taxes. Who are people going to vote for? How do you resolve that?
I think on all of these issues, whether it's aid to Africa, whether it's expenditure on big science research and so on, it is an educational question. If you can't educate your electors, and things like Live 8 do a lot to educate the public, because hundreds of millions of people will have seen some of that concert and absorb some of its message. If you educate electorates, and in most of the world, apart from Hong Kong and a few other places, we do have democratically elected governments, then they will elect leaders who will carry out policies, and there won't be the significant objections that you might find and the brainwashing that you get from people like George Bush on ruining the economy. Economies have signed up to Kyoto without ruining theirs.
Yeah, Bush has said he puts US interests first, and every leader puts their own national interests first.
Well, they need to remember that they are also leaders of the world. The problems don't stop at the borders. Global warming doesn't stop at the borders of America. It's quite clear that Bush is heavily aligned with the fossil fuels industry of America, and that has held back their policy.
It is also a proportional thing. For example, the world spend $15 billion on perfume, much more than the amount of money that people are willing to allocate for sub-African Africa.
Right. Okay. We're talking this morning about G8, about climate change and poverty reduction. What are your thoughts, your hopes, your questions, your comments? Do drop us a line. Give us a call. We've got a break for 5 minutes for the news now at 9 o'clock. We'll be back in five. Fine and very hot today. Maximum temperature 33 degrees, cloudy with a little rain at the weekend. 28 degrees at the moment. Relative humidity now at 86%.
HK.
You're listening to Backchat on Radio 3. Call us on 233-88266 or email backchat at rthk.org.hk. It's your voice.
Welcome back to the programme. This morning on Backchat, we're talking about the G8. Joining us on the line from the UK is Stephanie Tunmore, climate campaigner with Greenpeace International. Stephanie, you must have seen the Live 8 concerts in the UK at the weekend, last weekend.
Yes, I did. It was very, very good entertainment. I remember the original Live Aid, and this was just as exciting.
And what was the mood in the country? And what do you think? Do you think it will make a difference, things like that?
I think this year was very different to the last Live Aid. The last Live Aid was a call for money to help, you know, to support what was happening in Ethiopia. This was all about awareness raising. This was about politicizing young people, and I think in that respect, it probably has been successful, but I think we have to wait and see what comes out of the G8 summit. It's very, very easy to disillusion newly politicized people, and if there isn't the right result at the G8 summit, then that could, you know, turn people off politics and say, well, what's the point? They don't listen.
Do you think, I mean, is it young people who just don't understand the world who say these kinds of things?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a general apathy about politics around the world, and if you look at the amount of people that were marching on the streets over the Iraq war, and it still went ahead. But I think in young people especially, I couldn't speak for the rest of the world, but in the UK, we've seen that our students are far less politicized than they were 20, 30 years ago. And I think it's looking at politicians and thinking, well, they're not going to listen to us anyway, so what's the point? So I think things like Live Aid and the Make Poverty History campaign and Greenpeace campaigns as well will help to show people that they can make a difference, to show young people that it's their world, it's their future, and they can make a difference.
Do you think Live Aid does really put pressure on the politicians, the leaders of the world? Are they listening?
Well, it seems to have done. I mean, we'll wait and see what the outcome is, but certainly I've never seen such public awareness of a major summit. I mean, normally these things, apart from what happens on the streets at the time, usually pass without notice and without comment. But in the UK, certainly, this has been something that's been talked about for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Do you think there's too much lying on the G8 summit, that people are expecting too much from this meeting?
I would hate for people to be disappointed, but I don't believe that there is any such thing as too much pressure on world leaders. As one of your guests said earlier, they're not just political leaders, they're leaders of their country. They're elected by their country, and they owe their voters to do the best for them and for the country and for the world.
So, I didn't mean putting too much pressure on them. I meant that what is actually possible to come out of these meetings, like you yourself said, that America may well, their standpoint on climate control may well end up with the lowest common denominator being the sort of result of the meeting on that issue. Is it expecting too much that world leaders can come to an agreement on these issues?
Yes, so what you're saying is, are expectations being raised too high?
Yes.
I think it's difficult to say, but I think we should have high expectations of our leaders. And, you know, these are just eight human beings meeting together in a room. You know, they certainly know what the impacts of climate change will be. They've seen the passion from people who want the African situation sorted out. So why shouldn't we have that high expectations of them? That's what we elected them for.
Zhongchen Yao, I mean, we know something that is probably almost certainly going to come out already, a debt relief package which has been already agreed of $40 billion. $40 billion, a huge amount. You must be pleased with that.
Well, it's still not enough to address the serious poverty in Africa. We still have 20 million people suffering from HIV/AIDS, where many of them without access to drugs. And then there are still 100 million children not being able to go to school. So,
but does throwing money at the problem really help? Always help?
Well, World Bank has a report in 2002 saying that countries in these areas are able to absorb more aid or more money relieved from debt. So we are basing on prudent statistics and calculations. So it is the problem that demands attention and resources. Mm.
I think the debt relief, $40 billion, it does sound like a lot of money to most people. It's the net worth of one individual in America, in particular. But it's only the amount that the European Union will spend in 1 year subsidizing its farmers. Mm. This amount of debt has been accumulated over decades by African nations and other impoverished nations. But simply wiping the slate clean doesn't necessarily cure all their problems, because that debt was accumulated over time. A lot of it was accumulated through bad governance. Mm-hmm. And it's important that you put in place, when relieving debt, the checks and balances, the technical support, the governance support that these countries need. If they don't agree to sign up to those things, you're going to have to resort to aid only at the indirect level, bypassing the government and doing it with charities on the ground. That's not usually as efficient as reforming government policies, because you tend to be fighting against those government policies whilst you're trying to help people on the ground. At the same time, you can't hold the people suffering from malaria, AIDS, and lack of clean water to blame for the bad governance of their countries. So a balance has to be struck. But I think those countries that are willing to sign up to better governance, open their doors to scrutiny, not spend all the debt relief in terms of their new borrowing capacity on arms and so on, those countries should deserve more support.
Chung Chan Yao, do you think that many countries will be open to these kind of conditions?
I think so. I think we have also good results from the past. So debt relief in Tanzania, Uganda have produced results in children going back to school and health programs being reintroduced. So we have precedents to demonstrate that. And we agree with David that governance is very important. Supporting civil society in these countries is a means of making governments accountable. So I think that should also be part of the formula.
Mm. A lot of these countries have been, you know, former colonies and protectorates, and you know, have moved away from being governed by Western countries. Would this be seen by some of them as interference again with their affairs?
Well, we don't agree to strict conditionality based on donor countries. Particularly in the past, one of those has been tied aid. So we give you aid and you buy things from us. And that has led to a lot of malpractices and corruptions and so on and so forth. I think the governance improvement would certainly has to come from within. So imposing conditionality is sometimes not very effective. What we are trying to say is that good governance is certainly a major issues.
What would make it come from within, though? When you have a corruption that's so endemic, you know, there's no pressure for change, is there?
Well, I think as we said, the development of education, the development of civil society, these things can change, and also the investment practices. Companies coming into these regions, bringing good practices and not bad practices, that kind of things would help.
Stephen Cheung, I mean, from this perspective, we also have to ask, you know, why Africa, Asia, many Asian countries have been very poor, and things are turning around, and they have shared many of the same problems. They do share many of the same problems over governance and corruption and things like that. Mm-hmm. And yet it seems things in Asia are changing, things in Africa are not.
We see a couple of very different examples in Asia. We see China, we see India, and also we see Vietnam. These countries, actually, they suffer the same kind of problem that we mentioned, corruption, bad governance. And we still see, you know, this country has achieved a very high economic growth during the past two decades. And the problem is Africa. I mean, of course, you know, Zhang Yao has mentioned about a lot of problems that he see in Africa, such as improving governance, these kind of things. But all we know, I mean, these things that we know already, I mean, that in Economic 101, but the point is, how can we achieve a better governance in this country? We have been saying that for years. And my personal experience when I was a student in France 20 years ago, I have some African friends or classmates coming from Africa. We were classmates, we were young, and when we talk, when we discuss, I mean, in our dormitory, when we have a coffee time, they have they were full of ideas of how to transform African country or Africa, the continents, into a full democratic place and, how to improve governance. The problem is once my friends, some of them stay in Paris and some of them they return to Africa, some of them turn into work in the government and becomes that the part of government officials in African country. Of course, they will belong to the privileged group. And some of them forget about what we have discussed when why we were students in Paris and turn into part of the corrupted government official gangs. I think education is very important, but the point is educating the public is very important as well in Africa. How can we change the situation? I mean, it's a difficult situation.
Why did things change in Chongqing now? I mean, why are things changing in China and India and not in Africa?
Well, several things. We did a study in the 1990s. Number one, countries in East Asia are able to manage their market according to the pace of liberalization. Africa, many of them are forced to open by conditionality. Secondly, Asian countries are able to invest in education, health, welfare, which are the social infrastructure for growth. And in Africa, they are told that because of free market parameters, they cannot spend so much money there. They should spend rather, just open their economy. And then you see that the trade, the debt, the conflicts, many African countries suffer from conflicts. Some of them are caused by, are not at least not assisted by arms sales from European or American companies. So I think these are the differences that we observe.
David Webb, you any thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'll just make one general observation about governance. Just because you have an autocratic, dictatorial government, or authoritarian government, doesn't mean it will be a bad one. And you can end up with benevolent quasi-dictatorships like Singapore has, and like China, you could say, really, that they've pursued generally positive and pro-public growth policies that have had the effect of boosting their economy at rapid rates. But in the absence of any correction mechanism through the ballot box, you can also end up with corrupt, dominant, dictatorial thugs, basically, running countries for their own personal gain, squirreling the proceeds away in Swiss bank accounts, and generally converting all of the aid and debt that they receive, or large chunks of it, into personal wealth. In those situations, and it's very difficult, and you can look at things like Mobutu in Zaire, it's very difficult to see a way out unless there is either civil uprising, literally the people rise up and take over the government, or regional international pressure. And I think there what you need in Africa is a much stronger African Union. There are still large tariff barriers and artificial borders between the members of the African Union. They need to be imposing better governance on their member states and agreeing on protocols which would call on those member states to intervene if any particular state starts to behave in such an oppressive manner towards its people. So those kinds of peer pressure governance mechanisms are not really in place.
But is there anything Asia has done right that Africa could learn from, do you think?
Well, I think, as Mr. Chong was saying, it's about pursuing the basic infrastructure of civil society and trade liberalization, so that you invest in your economy and bring yourself out of poverty.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk, for example, about cutting agricultural subsidies in the European Union and North America and so on, and making trade freer in that sense. But I mean, if you remove the agricultural subsidies, that's a long way from African countries having the infrastructure and the focus to produce the goods and ship the goods to developed countries that they actually want. And
it's part of the overall equation. And I mean, African countries also need to remove barriers to inward investment. A lot of developing countries around the world put up limitations on foreign ownership of businesses. Now, China is guilty of that as well. It's only gradually lowering its barriers. It's only last year that you could own 100% of a retailer, for example, in China. You still can't own 100% of a bank. You can only own 19.9%, as HSBC will tell you. These things, they're all part of the overall liberalisation equation. It's not just about subsidies. But if the farmers of the European Union stop growing sugar because it's uneconomical for them to do so if they were asked to stand on their own feet, then countries in the Caribbean would be able to sell sugar at higher prices because there would be less sugar around. And be able to invest the proceeds in their economies.
All right, you talk about foreign investment. I mean, Chongqing Yao, you could imagine China going on an enormous, the biggest shopping, expedition ever in Africa, having so much cash. Would that be good for Africa?
Well, I want to address one or two points raised by David. Basically, we're looking to the WTO to get rid of agricultural subsidy in the coming meeting. So that's shared a target. Number two, we think that investments in developing countries should be managed, the openness. I think China has demonstrated that the ability of a government to manage the rate of openness, the readiness, that's very important. Some of the African countries suffer because of the imposition of conditionality by IMF. I think the your questions about, say, for example, cotton subsidy and sugar subsidy, that will bring immediate benefits because the farmers are already producing them in Africa, in Latin America, Caribbeans. So they're selling them. They're just not being able to sell them to Europe or other places because of the low price they're artificially achieved by subsidy in Europe and America. So I think that would be having immediate effect.
When you look at things like subsidies, that's a sort of across the board change that maybe the G8 countries can look at. But when you look at African countries, they really have to be looked at on a case by case basis, don't they? Because every country has its own problems, internal problems, governance problems.
Mm. Well, for example, one of the questions we haven't talked too much about is about conflict, say in Sudan. Right now, UN, African Union, and nobody is able to help settle the conflict. The refugees in Darfur areas, there are 1 million and 400,000 people killed. We don't agree to call this a genocide. Some country does, but it is a serious tragedy happening in front of us, and we lack a mechanism to deal with it. It was like 10 years ago, 11 years ago, about Rwanda, when the world was watching a genocide happening in front of us. So I think this is also a big cause of poverty in Africa that we need to remove.
How do we remove them? How do you remove conflict?
I think the UN needs to be empowered to do something. Right now, it's not. We are so much hostaged by U.S. policies. So if U.S. government wants to do some intervention, it does outside of the UN. If it is not in the current U.S. interest, then we don't see a multilateral institution being able to do that. So I think world leaders need to address that.
Yeah, there needs to be greater willingness, probably through the UN, to basically act as the schoolmaster in the playground. When two boys start fighting each other, you've got to go in and break it up, for the good of the overall region. That happens too slowly. It does eventually happen. If you ask Clinton, his greatest regret during his presidency, is often said, was failing to intervene in Rwanda. But the world did eventually go in and sort out the Bosnian conflict. And there needs to be a greater willingness to bring the resources of the developed world to bear on these developing world problems and almost impose multilateral solutions, peacekeeping solutions on countries and help them get back on their own feet and build institutions that will allow them to survive peacefully. But a lot of that, again, goes back to regional cooperation. I think it has to start more locally. It has to start with the African Union establishing standards of governance that, if its members breach, will give them the moral authority to come into those countries and sort things out. Mm-hmm. You can't give absolute sovereignty anymore to nations and say, well, you're a sovereign nation, so it's okay for you to abuse your people, to gas them or whatever.
Exactly. I think the same thing happens in Zimbabwe, for example. Yeah.
That's what Bush says, isn't it, in Iraq? I mean, it's not good enough for you to...
I think the Iraq situation was done for very different reasons. I mean, the behaviour complained of
was... I mean, yeah.
Well, they complained about gassing certain parts of the Iraq population, but that was 15 years before the invasion took place by the coalition, so not really connected. The main pretext was weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist.
All right. Stephanie Turnbull, finally, I mean, you're in the UK. I gather you're going to Glen Eagles today, is that right?
Yes, I will be.
Will you be going in an optimistic mood, do you think?
I think we hold no illusions that George Bush is going to suddenly do an about face and sign up to everything that the world needs him to sign up to. What we are hopeful of is that the other seven countries realise the urgency of the situation, and although it's unprecedented at G8 meetings, we would like to see a statement from G8 minus one. If President Bush continues to lag behind, well, leave him behind. I mean, this is such an important issue that we can't afford to be held hostage by U.S. intransigence. So we are hopeful that with the pressure from the developing countries, which will also be present at this meeting, that the other seven leaders will sign up to a communique, even if they have to make it clear that they couldn't reach agreement with the U.S. And I think one of the key things that could come out of this summit is a clear signal to business. And that's what they need. They need a signal which will tell them that the future is carbon constrained, and that will then change their investment patterns.
Right. And Chongqing Yao, are you optimistic?
Well, we are not. we are not optimistic that the G8 will move on trade issues. The debt, I think that's to us too small, too late. And the aid side, I think that's even more disappointing. So we are not optimistic, but we'll keep on campaigning.
Right. Stephen Chung is saying the poor are always with us. Is that right?
Yeah, I think aid, we should not be naive about aid. Aid could not reduce poverty. I think the efficient use of aid could be a help. I think at least the GA meeting could achieve something, as mentioned by Mr. Zhong, and then the debt relief could be done. But how about a more efficient use of aid? I think we need to see about that.
Okay. And David Webb? We were talking about Jeffrey Sachs' book, The End of Poverty. The subtitle is How We Can Make It Happen in Our Lifetime.
Well, I think that'll still be in print towards the end of our lifetimes. But these things are incremental in the real world. What we need to hope for is more substance and not just form, and that they will at least put the world on the right track towards the WTO ministerial conference in Hong Kong in December, when we can get a substantive agreement.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to Chung Chan Yang, Executive Director of Oxfam in Hong Kong. Professor Stephen Chung from the Department of Economics and Finance at City University, and joining us on the line from the UK, Stephanie Turnbull, who is a climate campaigner with Greenpeace International. That's it from us. Back at 8:30 tomorrow. That's me, Hugh Chiverton.
And me, Sarah Parswell. Thanks to...